Welcome to What the Papers Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on what the ones I find interesting. Okay, well this week we're going to start off with the following. This is from the Monday the 11th of September, and it's from page 10. Turks seize Smyrna. Kemalists high claim. Allies grave task. British force at Constantinople. Now, what is happening here is that, well, as you probably doubtless know, the First World War ended in 1918, and a series of treaties, well, you normally call it the Versailles Treaty, but there were a series of treaties, including Versailles, that were signed with the defeated powers. And the Treaty of Sèvres was the one that was signed between the Allies and the Ottoman Empire. It was quite a humiliation for the Ottomans because they lost in the whole of their Arab territories, modern-day Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, well, the bits of Saudi Arabia they had, Palestine. They also lost a large part of what was Armenia, or the northeast, what is now northeast Turkey. And they lost a large part of the west of Anatolia to the Greeks, as well as Thrace. If I could be bothered, I'd put up a map, which I probably can't. Well, I promise nothing on that regard, but do look it up on Wikipedia. It is there. Oh, yes, and of course, the Constantinople was occupied by the Allies. So what happened? Somehow, I mean, there was first of all a army rebellion led by Mustafa Kemal. And somehow, from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman army, which had fallen apart in 1918, he managed to create an army that was at first able to defeat the Armenian Soviets and to pretty much restore the Ottoman border in the east. At some point, and I'm not quite sure of the sequence of events, the Greeks decided to attack eastwards from Smyrna, and the Turks beat them. How this is somewhat mysterious, but they managed it. And this is the point where defeat is being turned into victory, and not a particularly nice victory either. Smyrna, as was, Izmir as is, was predominantly Greek, and the Turks are not in a particularly magnanimous mood. And in the course of their taking of Smyrna, they will kill thousands, and then, or during that time, they will set light to the city, and it burns. And this is, well, fairly well known. And this leads to the Greek expulsion from... It's not just the Greek army that's expelled from Anatolia, it's the Greek people. They no longer exist there, as far as I'm aware, or maybe a few here and there, but the vast majority were either killed or made refugees. This is going to have all sorts of implications, and I won't issue any spoilers at the moment, but its real significance is it means that the peace treaties that ended the First World War can be changed. The Allies demonstrate here they do not have the power, or they can't project their power into Turkey. And, of course, this has implications, because Germans are looking at this and thinking, well, if they can't project their power into Turkey, maybe they can't project their power into Germany. This is serious stuff. The next article comes from Friday the 15th of September, 1922, which I forgot to mention earlier. Cocaine traffic dangers. Heavier penalties to be enforced. Scope of the new bill. As foreshadowed in the Times, the government intends, during the autumn session of Parliament, to bring in a bill amending the Dangerous Drugs Act in order to deal more drastically with illicit trafficking in cocaine. The new measure will, it is believed, increase the maximum punishment for a first offence from 6 months to 12 months imprisonment. The context here is that until the Treaty of Versailles, most drugs were actually legal or quasi-legal. I never quite understood the, I think it's the Pharmacies Act 1868 and how that operated. I think, or it seems to me, that if you wanted some opium or some cocaine or whatever, you could go to your chemist, ask him nicely, and he would issue it to you so long as you signed the poisons book. That's my understanding, but I may stand corrected. But now it's been changed. Now things have changed, that they have decided that all these drugs, whether it be opium, cocaine, I think cannabis is about to be, has been banned. I'm not quite sure about that. Or maybe it's in another couple of years' time, but it will be banned at some point. So we have here the beginning of the drugs war, and as you can see, it doesn't seem to be going very well, at least not so far. Anyway, the article continues. Official experience shows that the chief difficulty in coping with the evil lies in the international traffic in cocaine, and that little blame attaches to the chemists and medical practitioners in this country. There may be a few chemists who, when they have a customer addicted to taking the drug, yield to his entreaties and serve him with a fresh quantity. But such court cases are thought to be rare. I must say, I find this part difficult to understand. On a recent trigonometry, there was a guy talking about drugs. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. But he was saying that up until about 1970, there was something called the British system. And under that system, more or less precisely this would happen. If someone was addicted, they would go along to their doctors, and the doctor would prescribe them something a little bit safer. In those days, I think it was, if you're a heroin addict, they give you some methadone. Now that's, it doesn't help much, but it may be a slightly, may mean that they're less likely to kill themselves. That was ended. I'm not sure the results are particularly positive. Anyway, they go on. The trouble lies with the international traffickers on the continent, where there is no difficulty at all in obtaining the drug, large supplies of which come from Germany. Oh yes, have a dig at the Germans. It may be true for all I know, but it's certainly the Times has no time for Germany at the moment. So if they get the chance to blame the Germans, they will. And it goes on, a certain amount of cocaine is undoubtedly smuggled into this country by foreign seamen. Blame the foreigners, eh? A British seaman, of course, would never think of such a thing. It is hoped in time to eliminate the use of cocaine altogether. Dentists now, in most cases, do not use it as a local anaesthetic, but prefer a less harmful substitute. The same is true, possibly in a somewhat lesser degree, of doctors. An apparently innocent prescription, said an official yesterday, which however contains cocaine, may lead to a patient's becoming a victim of the drug, and what has to be done is to find a really effective but harmless substitute. Some cocaine is undoubtedly taken by doctors themselves, who have the drug ready to hand, if they are badly overworked and are run down. Also, the pressure of work may cause some medical students to avail them of the drug, but these cases are not general. Oh yeah. The next article is from Saturday, the 16th of September, 1922, and is an editorial. Pasteurised milk. For the 12th week in succession, the infant mortality figure of London has been below 50. This is an experience of so unusual a character that too much attention can scarcely be directed to it. It means, as has already been sufficiently emphasised in our columns, that during the present autumn, young children have enjoyed a virtual immunity from the attack of one of their greatest and most deadly foes, infantile diarrhoea. It goes on. In any case, it would seem that the way to fight the infantile diarrhoea scourge is to make our milk supply safe. This, says Mr. Nathan Strauss, former president of the Department of Health in New York City, pointed out in our columns on Wednesday last, can be achieved by means of pasteurisation. Wherever, he declared, pasteurisation has been introduced, the mortality among infants has fallen off as if by magic. And it goes on, it says, pasteurisation is a comparatively simple process which any mother can learn. This is really quite extraordinary. I mean, I thought to myself, I thought, well, Louis Pasteur was, you know, doing his stuff in the 19th century and inventing pasteurization as a consequence. So I looked it up, and, well, he was. Louis Pasteur died in 1865. So we have a period of at least 50 and probably 70 years before people are taking his dictums on pasteurization seriously. What an extraordinary thing. What an extraordinary situation. But of course, it's not extraordinary. Medical progress, there can be a big gap, a big time lag between a medical discovery and the implementation of that discovery. A similar example, I believe, happened with Semmelweis. He was the man who discovered that if you wanted to keep people alive when you were operating on them, well, you better wash your hands. My understanding is that at the time, Semmelweis was regarded as a nutcase, and he was drummed out of the profession and died without anyone really recognising what he'd achieved. But now, well, we know that's essential to prevent an infection. So, even this, I'm very surprised to read. It's also interesting to note that, of course, I'm not quite sure this is true yet, but it probably is, that raw milk in this country is illegal. You can't sell it. For a long time, it was legal, but that was largely because the Queen Mother liked a pint. Not anymore, I think. I'm sure they banned that sort of thing. New Labour would have banned. Our next article comes from Friday the 15th of September and goes as follows. Soviet Army Scandal. Officers selling stores. The Soviet government recently appointed a commission under the leadership of the former head of the Cheka, Dzerzhinsky, to make an inventory of all state property. The commission was also instructed to examine the possibility of exporting a portion of this. The activities of the commission are now causing great anxiety to the higher officials. You know, well, yeah, I'm sure they are. I think anything which has Dzerzhinsky behind it would cause you high anxiety. But anyway, it goes on. The higher officials of the commissariats and other Soviet institutions. The commission has discovered large supplies of military stores which had not been registered, and Dzerzhinsky insists that the military authorities should give up the surplus. Skransky, the vice president of the military council, has, however, appealed to Rykov for his support. No, I don't know who these people are. Dzerzhinsky maintains that the supplies are being secretly disposed of by the higher military officials. He also asserts that besides the unregistered materials, there is a surplus of registered supplies which should be sold immediately. My, my, corruption in the Russian army. Who could have guessed? Anyway, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed that. And hopefully, I promise nothing, we'll be back next week.